This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hello, this is Max Potter for the Jodcast, and I'm joined by Mihalis Mathiudakis from Queen's University, Belfast.
Hello.
We just had your talk about solar magnetism and the DKIST telescope, which is going to be online in the near future. This is really exciting for me because it's a talk that I understand. It's about something related to my field, which is the solar corona. So why do we bother studying the sun? Everyone else is excited about things that are a lot further away than us around here. What got you interested in solar physics?
Well, I think we have to remember that the sun is the most important astronomical object for humankind. It drives space weather and has a direct impact on humanity. We have to also remember that the sun is a laboratory for astrophysics. It allows us to study the interaction between the plasma and the magnetic field over an enormous range of spatial scales, from a few kilometers up to hundreds or thousands of kilometers. So it's really a working example where the interaction between the plasma and the magnetic field can be studied in our backyard.
Brilliant, yeah. So we know so much more about the sun than we do about objects that are further away, and that's presumably just because it's so much closer to us and we've spent a lot longer looking at it.
Absolutely. And the sun has helped us so much to understand our universe. Not just our universe, but has helped us understand physical processes, even in laboratories. I have to remind you that helium was first discovered in the solar atmosphere, and we wouldn't know so much about neutrinos these days if we didn't have a constant stream of those particles reaching us from the sun.
Right, yeah. But our understanding of the sun has changed dramatically over the course of the last 50 or 60 years. Could you talk us through our changing understanding of the sun and how we've got from where we were to where we are today?
Our understanding of the sun has changed tremendously over the past 40 years or so. Back in the 50s and 60s, we thought that the solar atmosphere was plane parallel, very simple, vertically stratified with well-defined layers that we call the photosphere, the chromosphere, and the corona. In more recent years, we can see that it's a lot more complex than that. The chromospheric plasma does mix with coronal plasma. We have a lot more dynamic processes taking place over extremely short spatial and temporal scales. And this has only been possible with the advent of high-resolution instruments that have been put in space and on the ground.
Fantastic. So one such small-scale feature on the sun that we've only been talking about relatively recently are things called magnetic bright points, which were a feature of your talk that we've just heard. So what is a magnetic bright point and what can we learn from them?
Well, magnetic bright points are very small structures. I would say the smallest magnetic structures that we can resolve on the sun's photosphere. They have a diameter of about 100 kilometers, which is basically the current limit of our telescopes, and they are formed by the collection of magnetic flux that rises from the solar interior to the surface. They are bright because they have lower density than the surrounding medium, so when we look at their location, we can see deeper into the sun where the temperature is higher.
Okay. So by probing those lower levels of the sun where the temperature is hotter, what can we learn about it, and what's special about that?
Well, by studying magnetic bright points, we can understand how the small-scale field, which is in these tiny structures, merges together to form bigger structures like plage and sunspot regions. By studying those magnetic bright points, we can also study the dynamics of between the plasma and the magnetic fields on special scales, an unprecedented level by astrophysical standards.
Okay, and that'll be really helpful for things such as the theory, where it's very difficult to marry those small-scale plasma processes on the, you know, the very kinetic scale up to the big, large-scale MHD processes.
Absolutely, and we are getting a lot of guidance from theoretical models fit to allow us to design our observing sequences to search for the predictions of the models. Likewise, the observations, new findings from the observations are fed to the theorists so that they can modify their models to fit better the observational parameters.
Okay, fantastic. So we've got the observation and the theory speaking to each other in real time and everything's moving.
The observation and theory really have to go hand in hand, not just in solar physics, but in all areas of astrophysics and physics in general, if we are to advance the field.
Sure, definitely. So one thing, I mean, I'm studying magnetic reconnection in the corona, and it's really important that we can get good observations of the magnetic field on the sun. But of course, you can't see a magnetic field with the naked eye. So how is it that we can measure the magnetic field on the sun just by looking at it?
Well, as you said, we cannot see a magnetic field by naked eye, but we can see the signature of the magnetic field on the light of dedicated spectral lines. The Zeeman effect tells us that under certain conditions, certain atoms can have a splitting in their upper level, and the amount of splitting on the upper level of those atoms depends on the strength of the magnetic field. The splitting in the upper level of those atoms is then reflected into how broad that the line that we observed is. So by measuring those lines, measuring how broad the line profile is, we can go back and determine the strength of the magnetic field that created it.
Right. So if we've got a spectral line that we know is at a certain frequency, we can look and see how broad that is and then determine the strength of the magnetic field that broadened it in that region.
Absolutely. Okay. That's exactly the method that is used.
That's really cool. So why are some magnetic bright points so much brighter than others? You mentioned in your talk that you noticed two distinct populations of them. Do you have any idea about what causes some of them to be perhaps more stable at higher luminosities compared to the others? Or?
Our sort of preliminary results show that there are two groups of bright points, one group which has very strong magnetic field, another group which has much weaker field, and it's not exactly clear to us why this is happening. We speculate that bright points may evolve between the two groups, but the time it takes them to move from one group to the other is so short that cannot be captured with the time resolution of our existing instruments. Okay. So we have to push for higher temporal resolution to understand exactly what creates this bimodal population.
Right. So that's something we'll be looking at future generations of telescope.
This is something that we hope to be looking very soon and resolve basically the nature of that distribution, yes.
Cool. So something with a fairly exciting name that you talked about was the element bombs, which we can see on the sun, which to me sounded like a sort of very slow solar flare process, but happening much lower in the sun's atmosphere. What is an element bomb and why do they happen?
Well, element bombs were identified back almost 100 years ago by Ellerman with some of the very first solar observations. And their observational signature is an increase in the brightness in the outer wings of the hydrogen alpha line. They are similar to very small flares to some extent, but because they occur in the photosphere, where solar flares don't have a strong signature in H-alpha, that's why they are distinct. They are also distinct from solar flares because they are a lot less impulsive. Their rise to the peak and their decline back to their quiet state is a lot more gradual. Solar flares are a lot more impulsive. What creates Ellerman bombs? The most likely process that generates those Ellerman bombs is the annihilation of small-scale magnetic flux that is encountered in the photosphere.
Right. So potentially a similar mechanism to a solar flare then, in the sense that it's flux coming together and reconnecting into a new magnetic configuration.
The physical processes are likely to be very similar, yes.
Okay.
The observed parameters, the radiative parameter that we see may be different, but the physics we think is going to be very similar, yes.
Right. And they result in the surrounding temperature and magnetic field profiles changing quite dramatically for the photosphere.
Before the Ellerman bomb, we see a slow build-up in the localized magnetic field. And as that magnetic field diminishes and annihilates, we see the Ellerman bomb diminish as well. So it is strongly dependent on the build-up of that magnetic energy and its disappearance.
Right. So could you say that this is perhaps another example of our understanding of the sun becoming more dynamic, and there's more processes happening on different scales in places we don't expect? Is this new surprising information?
Well, it's another example that processes on the solar atmosphere occur on very small special scales.
Mm-hmm.
So every time we push the limits of our current instruments to the smaller structures, we tend to find new and exciting phenomena.
Okay, so that must mean you're very excited about the Deakist telescope, which, when is that coming online?
The Daniel K. Inouye Solar Telescope will have first light in 2019.
Okay.
It's a facility which is led by the National Science Foundation in the US, and its aim is to study solar magnetism down to special scales of a few kilometers.
Okay, fantastic. And it's a ground-based telescope. You were, in the talk, you were very passionate about ground-based observations for solar physics. But I was always taught that optical ground-based imaging was plagued with issues. How far has the field come, and why are these images so much better than some of the ones we've been getting from space?
Ground-based observations in the visible have always had the problems with atmospheric scene. Mm-hmm. So the reason why the field has advanced so much in recent years is due to adaptive optics. To be a little bit more specific, the scene, atmospheric scene, poses such a limitation that special resolution, a 4-meter solar telescope, is not different to that of a 10-centimeter telescope. And the only way to get a 4-meter telescope to achieve its full potential and observe the smallest structure that it is allowed by the diffraction limit of the aperture is by applying adaptive optics. And adaptive optics have revolutionized the field of solar physics and nighttime astronomy in the past 10 years. That's why there is now the big push to develop the large aperture solar telescopes.
So when we can move to this larger aperture telescope, how much better is that going to be than what we've seen previously?
Well, the structure that we're going to see on the surface of the sun will be at least 4 times smaller. We're going to have a resolution which is going to be at least 4 times better than our current telescopes. So again, this will allow us to study the magnetic field over even in smaller scales. And more importantly, it will allow us for the first time to measure the very weak polarization signal from the corona of the sun and determine directly the magnetic field strength in the outer corona.
Okay, and is that something that's not been achievable from ground-based observations before? Or?
Measurements of the coronal magnetic field from the ground or space have been very difficult because they require extremely high signal-to-noise and very accurate polarization optics. With the Deakist telescope, we have a much bigger aperture, 4-meter aperture, so the signal-to-noise will increase significantly, and the polarization optics are going to be much more accurate to allow us to disentangle that very weak polarization signal and therefore measure directly the magnetic field of coronal loops.
Okay, fantastic. So you were describing the technical challenges that are going to come from producing this much data with Deakist, because it's looking at so many different channels and it's at such a high resolution. Why does it need such a demanding specification, and how are you working to meet that?
Deakist is going to be producing data at a rate of about 2.5 gigabytes per second for each of the cameras that we are going to supply. And we're going to be supplying 9 cameras. If you take into account that it's going to be observing for 5 to 6 hours a day, the data that are going to be produced on a daily basis are going to be of the order of hundreds of terabytes. The need for such a large data array, the need for such a high cadence, which results in the high data array, is because we are going to be applying image reconstruction techniques that will allow us to take out the scene effects and get down to the diffraction limit resolution. So adaptive optics combined with image reconstruction techniques will achieve the required resolution. Image reconstruction will be using approximately 30 frames every second to produce 1 frame at the resolution that can be achieved by the 4-meter aperture.
Mm-hmm. And some of those results that you have simulated that you'll be able to achieve with this telescope were quite striking. And even some of the pictures that have already been taken with ground-based observatories were very impressive. Where can people go to see some of those images, like that one that you showed us of the photosphere?
Those images can be seen in the website of some of the current facilities, and these are the Swedish Solar Telescope, the new solar telescope at Big Bear. The Swedish Solar Telescope is on the island of La Palma. The Dance Solar Telescope, which is in the in New Mexico. So by visiting their websites, you can get some of the spectacular imaging.
Brilliant. Yeah, I would highly recommend that people do that, because I was very impressed with it. Having, you know, I've seen pictures from the Solar Dynamics Observatory and things that are online at the minute, and of the corona, and it, beautiful images particularly the coronal rain loop that's on YouTube. But this stuff is really sharp and really crisp, and it's parts of the sun that you don't usually get to see, so that's really interesting.
I think I would like to emphasize at this point that ground-based observations work very closely with planners of the space missions.
Sure.
Because it's really only with the synergy between ground-based observations and space-borne observations that will allow us to disentangle the process that's taking place on the sun.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So where will these new resolutions and this new capability, where will this push our understanding? Which areas of the sun are we most interested in, and what do we expect to find?
Well, we're going to be, with DKIST, we will be able to resolve the fine structure in the umbra of sunspots, because there are currently predictions that there is a lot of fine structure that we are not seeing. Mm-hmm. And as you are well aware, the sunspots lead to flares and eruptive phenomena. With DKIST, we will also be able to study direct flare phenomena and see how the flare energy builds up in flares and how does that energy is released. And the processes that lead to the energy release in flares is very important because they affect our terrestrial environment.
Sure. So one thing that you talked about that could be really exciting is the potential use to learn about exoplanets from our current models of the sun. So by studying this object that's really close to us, it's our best example of a star that we have. How can we turn the knowledge we gain here into knowledge about the rest of the universe?
Given that the sun is a star, I think it's very important that we understand our own star, which is in our own backyard, before we go and understand other stars. Of course, the sun is only one star, so we don't want to be carried away and assume that every other star behaves like the sun.
Sure.
However, we have to remember that more than 90% of the stars in the night sky have activity and convective envelopes behave like the sun. So understanding solar granulation, the very small radiovelocity signal that we get from the smaller structure on the photosphere of the sun, we can understand how granulation in other stars behave, and it's that very weak granulation signal that acts as astrophysical noise on top of the signal that they're trying to detect when we try to find out Earth-like exoplanets. So understanding how that noise, so to speak, from the sun, the granulation noise, behaves, and applying that to other stars, we can then subtract that noise and find the net radiovelocity signal that an exoplanet may be inducing on a solar-like star.
Brilliant stuff. Mihalis Mathiudakis, thank you very much.
Thank you.